End of the regular season. After winning the Western Conference, the Packers left for Tulsa for a week of training in preparation for the NFL championship game. The title match was in Dallas against the Cowboys, who had won the Eastern Conference in their sixth year under coach Tom Landry. For more than three decades, the NFL title game had been the ultimate in pro football. But this year, it had a penultimate feel. If Lombardi's team beat Dallas, there would be one more game. The NFL and AFL had ended their war and agreed to a gradual merger. The symbol of football peace would be a first-ever playoff between the two leagues for the world championship. "Last go for Lombardi?" asked a headline in the Dallas Times-Herald 5 days before the NFL title game. In an interview with sports writer Steve Perkins on the Tulsa practice field, the coach intimated that the answer might be yes. Lombardi himself brought the subject of retirement up when he was told of a remark by linebacker Ray Nitschke, who said that this game against the Cowboys was the biggest for Lombardi since he came to Green Bay, Perkins wrote. Lombardi instinctively bristled at the presumption of a player deciding what was biggest for his coach. When Perkins explained that Nitschke meant this was the first NFL title game where the winner went on to something more, Lombardi relaxed somewhat. "Oh, well, that's very true," he said. "And another thing that makes it a big one is that it could be my last one." Why would he quit now? "The job has become too much to handle. I think it's time I gave somebody else a chance. There used to be an off-season. For that matter, there used to be some time off during the season. I remember when I was in college, I used to drop in on the Giants' meetings. They had one reel of film, and they'd show it to a team one time, and that was it." Perhaps Lombardi wanted to relax, but couldn't bring himself to, just as he sometimes longed to be more like his carefree playboys, Hornung and McGee. But more likely, his concern was that the nature of his job had changed. Once, it was hard for him to distinguish between work and play. They fit together like the tattoos etched into his father's knuckles. Now it was work on one hand and more work on the other. This week, he had to work harder than ever. It would be painful for him to lose to Landry, even when they were on the same side as the top assistants for Jim Lee Howell in New York. They'd been competitors. The explosive Vinny's offense against Cool Tom's defense. Lombardi had set himself apart in the years since, but people were starting to write about Landry as the mind of a new age. Landry and his multiple offense and flex defense, making football seem robotic and complicated, enough to goad Lombardi into devising a new offense for one game, which is just what he did in shockingly cold Tulsa that week. Lombardi's schemes worked well enough when it counted in Dallas. On the first play from scrimmage, Elijah Pitts popped through a hole in the flex for 34 yards, and a few plays later, Starr connected with him for a 17-yard touchdown. Pitts had the same nose for the goal line as his mentor Hornung, who had been out since the second Bears game, his shoulder inflamed again by a hit from Doug Buffone. On the next kickoff, Mel Renfro fumbled, and Jim Grabowski scooped up the ball and galloped in for another score. "My feet never touched the ground after I reached the end zone," Grabowski said later. "I floated back to the sidelines." Starr threw four touchdown passes before the day was over, and Lombardi's offense had 34 points, but the game was in doubt until the last play. Tom Brown, the strong safety, was having as much trouble with Cowboys tight end Frank Clark as he once had with the curveball during his cup of coffee with the Washington Senators. In the fourth quarter, with the Packers leading 34-20, Clark ran a pattern straight at Brown, turned him the wrong way, and broke clear to catch a 68-yard touchdown pass from Don Meredith. Dallas got the ball back in the final minutes, and Clark ran the same damn play to beat me again, Brown recalled. This time, Brown grabbed Clark as he was going by, and the referee called interference. Ball on the Packers, two. A touchdown to tie. And it seemed almost inevitable. But an offensive lineman moved before the snap, a critical penalty that cost the Cowboys 5 yards. On fourth down, Meredith tried to roll right, and there was Big Dave Robinson hunting him down, and Meredith, in desperation, tossed the ball high and gentle into the end zone, and there was the prayerful Tom Brown waiting for redemption. God, yeah, he said to himself as he cradled the ball. In the locker room after the game, Dave Robinson was sitting on his stool receiving congratulations from teammates. Lombardi came by and stared at him, unsmiling. Later, in private, Lombardi would hug Robbie and praise him for the game-winning play, but now he wanted to make another point. "You weren't supposed to be blitzing," he growled and walked away, thinking already about more work. Now he had to make sure he didn't lose it all to the Kansas City Chiefs. The game was a lowercase phenomenon that first year at the Los Angeles Coliseum. Super Bowl. No Roman numerals attached. Lamar Hunt, owner of the Chiefs, took the name from his grandson's toy, a high-bouncing Super Bowl. The official name on the game programs was World Championship Game AFL versus NFL. The Packers went to Santa Barbara for a week of training. The superstitious Lombardi considered it good luck to stay in cities named for Saints. And were of two minds about how seriously to take the Chiefs. Much of what they saw on film made them dismissive of the other league. Sherman Plunkett, an offensive tackle for the New York Jets, his prodigious gut sprawling over his belt, became their symbol of the sloppy AFL. Every time he appeared on film, Henry Jordan shouted, "Hey, roll that back, look at Plunkett!" And the Packers all laughed. Plunkett did not play for the Chiefs, of course, but the films also revealed plenty of ways to exploit Kansas City on offense and defense. Particularly noticeable was the way their linebackers would stay near the line of scrimmage and not drop back into pass defense. "We had them checked," said Willie Wood. "It was just a matter of how emotionally involved we were going to get." That was Lombardi's job, and he took to it with manic intensity. The practice sessions in Santa Barbara were unforgiving. "He was miserable that week. He liked to have killed us," said Bob Skoronski. "I personally thought he was going to leave the game on the practice field, the only time I ever thought that." Lombardi was so obsessed that Marie left for Las Vegas for 2 days, and he barely noticed she was gone. "You mean you flew over the mountains?" he said to her when she got back. "No, dummy," she replied. "I flew under them." No relaxation for his men, no distractions. He raised the fines for curfew violations to record amounts. "Vince made it very clear from our first day out there that we had to win that game and that he didn't want to make a squeaker out of it," said Red Cochran, his offensive assistant. Lombardi had nothing to gain. "One loss and all was lost," he said. If he lost, it would diminish everything that he'd accomplished since he got to Green Bay. The championships of 1961... 1962, and 1965. The NFL title win over Dallas in 1966. If he couldn't beat the Kansas City Chiefs, what would any of that mean now? There were other reasons they had to win. Not just for his legacy and theirs, but for the NFL. Tony Canadeo said Lombardi felt that he was carrying the league on his shoulders. "If we'd have dumped that game, God, everyone would have blamed the Packers." Even before they reached Santa Barbara, the pressure had started. "We were getting all kinds of telegrams and telephone calls from all these millionaires who own teams," said Ruth McCloskey. "Go get it. Go get 'em, Vince." And over the league teletype, Everyone giving advice, watch this, watch that. Every time something came in, you could see this grim look on Mr. Lombardi's face. The NFL was all uptight about it, so he was very upset. What the owners said to Lombardi, Lombardi said to his players. He told us this was for a way of life, a game of survival, a test of manhood. Remembered Willie Davis. Lombardi received a letter from Wellington Mara of the Giants that moved him so much he read it to his team. Like other owners, Mara reminded Lombardi how essential it was that the NFL team win, but he ended his note with the ultimate compliment. He was happy, Mara said, that it was Lombardi and his Packers, among all the league's teams, carrying the NFL standard. Before dinner on the eve of the game, Max McGee spotted Ray Scott in the lobby of the Packers Hotel in Los Angeles. McGee was nearing the end of his career and hadn't played much that season. He'd caught 4 passes all year, playing behind Boyd Dowler and Carroll Dale. But Dowler had been hurt while scoring a touchdown against Dallas, so McGee paid more attention than he might have to the game films. Scott, the Packers' regular season play-by-play man, was working the game for CBS. The competition in the television world was as fierce as the one between the leagues. CBS was the NFL network. NBC had the AFL, and both had rights to the game. McGee motioned to Scott to come with him to a corner of the lobby, behind a potted tree. He had a scoop. "Scotty," he said, "I don't know if I'm going to get in that game tomorrow, but if I do, they'll never get old Max out." "What do you mean?" Scott asked. "I've been studying film, and I've found me a cornerback. I'm going to have him for breakfast, lunch, and dinner." Then McGee went back to his room to see if Paul Hornung wanted to go out on the town with him. The week in Santa Barbara had been frustrating for McGee, not Lombardi's practices, but the fact that there was nothing to do at night. He was wired and ready for action by the time he reached Los Angeles. Before conspiring with Scott behind the lobby tree, he'd met a few stewardesses in the bar, and they'd agreed to meet later that night. "Horn," he said to Hornung back in their room, "I made a little deal. Gonna meet a couple of girls." But Hornung declined. He knew that he wasn't likely to play the next day. The nerve in his shoulder was still bothering him, but the notion of paying thousands of dollars to break curfew didn't appeal to him. "He had a little more value of money than I did," McGee explained later. Hog Hanner, who'd retired and was now an assistant coach, was in charge of the curfew bed checks that night. McGee and Hanner had snuck out together many a night in the old days. The night before the Chiefs game, Hanner went to Max and Paul's room first. They were always checked first on the theory that if they were in, everybody was in. Hogg stuck his head in the door and saw McGee under the blankets, covered to his neck. "Okay, you guys, you're here now," Hanner said. "Hogg, you gonna check us again?" McGee asked. "Yeah, gol dang, I'm gonna check you guys every hour," Hanner responded. As he closed the door, he looked back one last time and shook his head no. Minutes later, McGee was on his way. He returned to the hotel the next morning just as Bart Starr was walking through the lobby to buy a paper and get breakfast. Starr noticed that Max was wearing the same sport coat and shirt he had on the night before. When McGee got back to the room, he asked Hornung, "Am I safe?" "No," said Hornung. "They caught your ass. You're shitting me." Nothing happened." McGee was so relaxed, he napped for an hour and looked refreshed boarding the bus for the stadium. Lombardi was the last man on. He took his seat, front right, and the driver shut the door and started to pull out. "Just a minute," Lombardi said. "Stop a minute." He rose to his feet, stepped into the aisle, got the attention of his players, and danced a soft shoe. The players started screaming, "Go, coach, go!" When he sat down, Jack Kepler asked him, "What the hell was that?"
They were too tight,
Lombardi said. The game would be watched by the largest television audience ever to view a sports event, more than 65 million people. But in person, it didn't feel historic. There were 61,946 people inside the Memorial Coliseum, more than enough to fill Lambeau Field, but they seemed lost inside that monstrous stadium. The most expensive ticket was $12, and still more than a third of the seats went empty. Pete Rozelle saw Ed Sabol in the locker room before the game and handed him 15 complimentary tickets. Sabol passed them along to one of his cameramen, who went outside with the freebies. He returned later with 5 tickets that he couldn't even give away. Steve Sabol took his NFL Films camera out for the coin toss and had the strange sensation that there was a bigger crowd at midfield with the officials, the two networks, the still photographers, the team captains, than there was in the stands. A band played the national anthem, and virtually no one in the audience sang. As the game began, McGee and Hornung were sitting on the bench together, not paying attention. They were making plans for an unlikely event. The marriage of the Golden Boy later that month to Patricia Roeder, a Green Bay native now in Hollywood. Max was throwing a bachelor party for him in Las Vegas, and then they would come back to Beverly Hills for the wedding. They were getting all of that lined up, just two guys talking on a Sunday afternoon, could have been anywhere, and then a single word pierced their consciousness. McGee! Hornung looked at McGee, and McGee looked at Hornung. And the first thing that passed through McGee's mind was that Lombardi was going to fire him right there in front of a full stadium and 60-some million people watching on television. McGee, get in there! Lombardi was screaming. Dowler had tried to play, but his shoulder was still hurting from the Dallas game. Lombardi needed an end. He could have gone with someone younger, but he trusted McGee in big games. Max was eager, he'd watched the films, but still, this was unexpected. He didn't even know where he had put his helmet, and grabbed the first one he could find. It belonged to a lineman. He looked like Ned the third grader going out there, Hornung said. No passes came his way during the first series, but when he came back to the bench, he told Hornung, "If Bart'll throw me the ball, I'll win the car. They're not even covering me." The car was the 67 silver Corvette convertible that Sport was giving to the game's most valuable player. He passed the same message along to Starr. In the next series, he slipped past the cornerback, broke into the clear over the middle, and reached back effortlessly to bring in Starr's slightly errant pass for a 37-yard touchdown. Perhaps there was something to be said for ignoring Lombardi and staying out all night. McGee was among the few Packers playing free and easy. Willie Wood had 2 interception chances, but was too anxious and dropped them. Ray Nitschke was so keyed up he forgot his assignment on several plays. The Packers were playing hard, but just missing, and took a precarious 14-10 lead to the locker room at halftime. Lombardi told his men that they were too tight. Nitschke muttered to his defensive pals, "Well, who the hell does he think got us so nervous in the first place?" In the first half, Lombardi continued, they adjusted to Kansas City. "Now I want you to go out there and make Kansas City adjust to you." That was all it took. Not a change in the game plan, but a subtle adjustment of attitude. Don't worry, you're the best, make them respond, go after them. The key play of the game came early in the third quarter. 3rd and 5 for the Chiefs near midfield. Quarterback Len Dawson tried his patented rollout pass, but Leroy Caffey, the big turkey, was blitzing from outside linebacker and forced Dawson to throw hurriedly toward his tight end, Fred Arbanas. Willie Wood, loose at last, stepped in, made the interception, and raced down to the 5-yard line. Elijah Pitts scored on the next play, and the game was theirs. McGee came back to the huddle after every play, urging Starr to throw to him. He caught 7 passes for 138 yards and thought he could have had twice as many if the ball had come his way more often. Winning wasn't everything to Lombardi this time. Winning big was. When it got to 35-10, he started feeling good. And when Donnie Anderson smacked Kansas City's boastful defensive back, Fred Williamson, with a churning knee, he felt even better. Williamson wore white cleats like Joe Namath and was a trash talker long before the phrase entered the sporting lexicon. He'd been boasting all week about his tackling technique, which he claimed had busted open the helmets of 30 opponents over the years. Hence his nickname, The Hammer. And how exactly did the Hammer do it? With a blow delivered with great velocity perpendicular to the Earth's latitudes, I grabbed the guy with one arm, anywhere from his waist up, preferably around the neck, and slam him to the ground, and boy, it smarts. During film sessions in preparation for the game, Lombardi concluded that Williamson was the dirtiest player he'd seen. If he hits one of our men in the back or head or throws one dirty elbow, he's out of there, Lombardi told his team before the game. And now Anderson had knocked him out, accidentally, just by lifting a gangly leg into Williamson's chin. When he went down unconscious, the Green Bay bench erupted with noise. Who was it? Who got hit? That's the Hammer. Willie Wood yelled out, They just nailed the Hammer. The Packers had made the Chiefs adjust. The Hammer was carried out on a stretcher. After the game, Steve Sable sought out Lombardi for a brief interview for NFL Films. The locker room was relatively quiet, no yelping or spraying champagne. After the award ceremony, Sable found the coach in his dressing quarters struggling to take off his tie. Long ago, in another locker room, Vinnie Lombardi had been overtaken by joy when the young and outmatched cadets of Army had stunned Duke at the Polo Grounds, and he had moved triumphantly among his players that afternoon with a pair of scissors, cutting off their sweat-soaked T-shirts, the symbols of hard-won victory. Now, in the moments after winning his 4th pro championship in 6 years, the symbol was not a player's sweat-soaked shirt, but a coach's knotted necktie. The tie said everything about Lombardi and the pressure he was under to win. He'd cinched a Windsor knot so tight that he couldn't undo it no matter how vigorously he yanked and pulled. The tie was his noose, and he was hanging himself, until finally, in exasperation, he asked the equipment man for a pair of scissors and cut it loose from his straining neck. Chapter 23. In Search of Meaning. Fox River? Frozen. The Bay? Frozen. Christmas and the cheer of a new year? Long gone. The glow of a new spring? Impossibly far away. Green Bay took on a bleak and empty cast in late January and early February. The setting was colorless and without relief. Gray plumes of paper mill smoke lingered in a cold gray sky. The sub-zero temperatures and dirt-encrusted snowbanks were nothing new, but earlier they had provided local atmosphere for the stretch run of the champion Packers. By the end of January, football memories had faded, and even a Super Bowl season seemed as old and flat as a half-drunk bottle of last night's Blatz. The doldrums of 1967 could have been worse. Lombardi might have stopped coaching. But instead he said that his comments in Tulsa before the Cowboys game were the idle musings of an exhausted man. He wouldn't retire, not with the possibility of winning an unprecedented 3 straight titles. The Pope's reign would continue, though there was one new casualty. Red Cochran, the offensive assistant, quit even before the team playing got back from the Super Bowl. 7 seasons with an obsessed boss were enough. The pressure to win just got to Red, reported his wife Pat. Vince was hard to live with day after day. It's human nature that famous people can become more difficult to live with in direct proportion to their rising public esteem. Lombardi was more celebrated than ever that winter as he continued the transition from winning football coach to national icon. He'd become especially popular in the business world, where his sayings on leadership were admired by a growing legion. That crossover process had begun in a small way years earlier when a pharmaceutical company bought several boxes of Run to Daylight and assigned its sales force to read the book during a convention in Florida. Bill Hines had noticed then that his co-author was fascinated by the guys who were big business executives, and now it amazed Lombardi that they were also fascinated by him. With pride and nervousness, he accepted an invitation from the American Management Association to speak on February 8th at its annual personnel conference in New York. What would he say? In his rhetoric, he made it sound easy to transfer football lessons to business, but to friends he confided that he was not all that sure. When responding to letters, Lombardi's habit was to write his answers in a long, looping script on the back of the correspondence and have them typed by his office assistant, Lorraine Keck. But for speeches, he used a different process. The ideas for his New York speech came to him as he paced his stadium office and spoke into a dictaphone in rhythmic cadences, slowly spelling each difficult word and instructing Keck on punctuation. Although, as Hines once told him, Lombardi was virtually useless when it came to recalling vivid anecdotes from his own life, he had a powerful memory for rhetorical phrases. He could remember a speech almost verbatim after reading it twice, and deliver it relying on note cards with a few key words. Lombardi was not a creative thinker, but he was a methodical gatherer and organizer. For years, he'd been collecting philosophical thoughts and sayings in paragraph chunks, filing them away like football plays in his brown leather satchel. And for a speech, he would take them out and reshape them neatly in his own style, then fit them together one on top of another as if they were little square blocks of granite. Some of his ideas were taken from popular culture, magazine essays, and motivational books, but more were mined from the lessons of his own past. They came from Harry's tattoos and Maddie's scoldings, from the exercises of Ignatius of Loyola, the lectures of Father Cox, the halftime orations of Sleepy Jim Crowley, the leadership psychology of Red Reader, the pronouncements of General MacArthur, and the axioms of Colonel Blake. That was how he constructed his New York speech, and from then on, rather than create something new, he mostly rearranged the same familiar blocks. The Great Lakes region below Green Bay was buried in snow that February, record amounts from central Wisconsin down through Chicago and around to Detroit. The paralyzing weather began with what Life described as a preposterously uncivilized blizzard that struck Chicago in late January, dumping 24 inches in 29 hours, 24 million tons of snow on the city alone, closing O'Hare International Airport for 3 days. Another storm arrived on February 2nd, and yet another 4 days later, silencing Milwaukee under a foot of snow. The storms then moved east and pounded New York with a double blow, first 3 inches of snow and a 40-degree temperature drop, then the full force of a blizzard. More than a foot of snow fell overnight and into the morning of February 7th, closing LaGuardia and Kennedy airports. The New York Stock Exchange and Macy's shut down early, and the lobbies of Midtown Manhattan hotels overflowed with men in galoshes carrying attaché cases, stranded commuters desperately seeking overnight lodging. It was in the midst of this storm that Lombardi made his way from Green Bay to New York to deliver his speech at the personnel conference. With major airports on both ends socked in by snow, he traveled by rail, his first long train ride since his days as an assistant at West Point. He sat in the parlor car most of the journey from Chicago eastward, talking, drinking, and playing cards with two judges, Christ Seraphim of Milwaukee and John Pappas of Boston. Pappas had been an owner of Suffolk Downs Racetrack and a major importer of Spanish olives. Seraphim, known for dispensing a harsh brand of justice, was a casual acquaintance of Lombardi's and had dined with him several times before Packers games in Milwaukee. Once, years earlier, as Lombardi's party sat around a table at a Bayside restaurant, Seraphim and the coach had argued passionately over the roots of crime. The judge blamed crime on the bad character of individuals. Lombardi insisted that society shared responsibility for allowing desperate conditions to exist. Now, according to Seraphim, Lombardi's views were edging closer to his. As the train rolled east, Seraphim recalled, they bemoaned a society where people thought they could break the law with impunity. At several stops along the route, Lombardi had been calling conference officials in New York to update them on his progress. It was slow going, he told them, but not to worry, he was on his way. By early Wednesday morning, he'd reached Philadelphia and called again. There were more delays on the corridor, he reported, and he feared it was now touch and go whether he could make it on time. Lawrence A. Apley, president of the American Management Association, suggested that Lombardi might consider staying in Philadelphia. He could deliver his speech from there over a speakerphone piped into the conference hall at the Americana Hotel. Calling it in, no way Lombardi would agree to that. He'd worked too hard on the speech. He'd gone through too much already, and phoning from Philadelphia would have drained the power from his message on strong leadership. "I've gotten this far," he said, rejecting Apley's offer. "I'll get there. Hold them if you can." Apley turned to his director of conference arrangements, George DeSegni, and said, "Look, I don't know if he's going to make it for lunch, so we'll have to delay a bit. Let's put on a big cocktail party for our guests." As the 1,200 executives sipped cocktails in the hallway outside the grand ballroom, Apley announced that Lombardi was slowed by the snowstorm and that lunch would be delayed an hour. Since this was the final session of a 3-day conference, anyone who had to leave would be excused and reimbursed for lunch. Virtually no one left. This was a predominantly male huddle, hopped up about seeing the famous football coach, and by 1 o'clock it was a decidedly well-lubricated crowd as well. Still, no speaker. Jim Cabrera, an assistant program director, was sent down to Penn Station to greet the slow-moving train. He kept a taxi idling outside for the trip back to the hotel at 7th Avenue and 53rd Street. Cabrera knew the car and compartment number, and was there ready to grab a suitcase as soon as Lombardi stepped onto the platform. "He's here! We're on the way!" he reported back to DeSegni from the nearest phone, and the personnel executives were ushered into the ballroom for lunch. They were finishing the salad course when a murmuring began, and suddenly the crowd was on its feet, and the large ballroom exploded with applause. An unbelievable standing ovation, as DeSegni recalled it. Vince had made it. Lombardi strode to the podium in a dark suit, his hair freshly trimmed, a championship ring shining from his left hand. He loved to wear rings and had just designed the Super Bowl version, which had the word character etched on one side and love on the other. For someone who'd been rushed to the Americana after enduring an exhausting overnight journey, he looked amazingly fresh and neat. William D. Smith, who covered the event for the Times, wrote in his story the next day that the audience listened almost spellbound as Lombardi lectured them on leadership. Joe Lombardi, the coach's youngest brother, was in the audience as a special guest and remembered that when Vince finished, the room was silent. Joe looked up to the lectern and noticed a startled look on his brother's face. There was a moment of almost panic. Did they like it? What's going on? Then the silence broke. Another rousing standing ovation. As Smith described it, the mostly paunchy and out-of-shape audience seemed ready to carry Lombardi out on their shoulders and then go out and take on the Kansas City Chiefs. The speech itself was not recorded beyond a few snippets in Smith's article in the AP, and the prepared text seems to have been lost to history. Lombardi's hosts didn't receive a copy. His secretaries in Green Bay maintained an archive of his speeches for posterity, but that one was not among them. In many of his later speeches, however, Lombardi referred to the American Management Association address as the first of its kind. He considered it a seminal moment in his emergence as a public figure known for more than winning football games. Virtually every major speech that he delivered in later months and years was a variation of what he said that snowy Ash Wednesday in 1967. Lombardi structured his standard speech around seven themes, his seven square blocks of granite that fit one atop the other. These themes went deeper than his mentor Red Blake's axioms, which didn't seem to cohere into a larger philosophy. Axiom: inches make the champion, and a champion makes his own luck. But it was nonetheless clear that Lombardi lifted some of his thoughts and words from Blake. This was especially true for his first theme, the meaning of football itself. Many of Blake's long-held thoughts on football were contained in his autobiography, You Have to Pay the Price, first published in 1960. In it, he described football as the game most like life. In Lombardi's speech, it was a game very much like life. Blake said it was a game that is 100% fun when you win and that exacts 100% resolution when you lose. Lombardi called it a game which gives 100% elation, 100% fun when you win, yet demands and extracts a 100% resolution, 100% determination when you lose. Blake described it as a game of violent body contact. Lombardi characterized it as a violent game, and to play it any other way but violently would be imbecilic. To Blake, it was a game played in some form by over a million young Americans, a game uninhibited by social barriers. Lombardi said it was a game played by millions of Americans, yet is completely uninhibited by racial or social barriers. Blake called football a Spartan game that required sacrifice, selflessness, competitive drive, and perseverance. Lombardi said it demanded the Spartan qualities of sacrifice, self-denial, dedication, and fearlessness. That this was some minor form of unattributed borrowing is beside the point. It's even possible that the precise words came originally from neither man, but from Tim Cohane, the erstwhile Fordham publicist who collaborated on Blake's autobiography and wrote several articles with Lombardi for Look. Lombardi, in his speech, said that he had been in football all his life, and that although he sometimes wondered why he stayed in an occupation as precarious as football coaching, he didn't feel particularly qualified to be part of anything else. The point is that he was a Blakeian in football in the same way that he was a Catholic in religion. It was what he knew and what he believed in without question, and if he recited verbatim from the Colonel's football missal, it was only as an expression of true devotion. Lombardi's second theme, a block fitting onto the first, concerned the value of competition, what he called the American zeal to compete and win. Over the years, he'd grown increasingly worried about the lack of interest in competition, particularly athletic competition among our young people. He took particular note when the trend away from competition hit close to home, when small Catholic colleges like his own Fordham de-emphasized sports, for instance, or when Admiral Hyman Rickover complained that the military academy stressed competitive sports too much. Men needed the test of competition to find their better selves, Lombardi insisted, whether it was in sports, politics, or business. 15 years earlier, as an assistant at West Point, he'd traveled to New York to show Army game films to General MacArthur, and he'd listened attentively as the old soldier, in his tattered gray bathrobe, lectured him on the merits of competitive sports. Although he'd coached for 5 years at West Point, Lombardi was not a military man. He knew little about the military controversies of MacArthur's career, leaving the Philippines in World War II, driving his men to a bloody Red Chinese ambush at the Yalu River in Korea a decade later. He knew that Red Blake adored MacArthur and that MacArthur had a stirring rhetorical style which he couldn't help drawing on in his speech. "I need no greater authority than the great General MacArthur, and I would like to quote some of the things he said to me. Namely, competitive sports keeps alive in all of us a spirit of vitality and enterprise. It teaches the strong to know when they are weak and the brave to face themselves when they are afraid, to be proud and unbending in defeat, yet humble and gentle in victory, to master ourselves before we attempt to master others, to learn to laugh, yet never forget how to weep, and it gives a predominance of courage over timidity." The third block in Lombardi's speech was about striving for perfection, what he called a man's personal commitment to excellence and victory. Perfection was to be considered on a more ethereal realm than mere competition. Winning was part of it, but not all of it. His mother, Matilda, had instilled in Lombardi an anxious perfectionism. The Jesuits had taught him that human perfection was unattainable, but that all human beings should still work toward it by using their God-given capacities to the fullest. "While complete victory can never be won," Lombardi said, "it must be pursued, it must be wooed with all of one's might. Each week there is a new encounter, each year there is a new challenge. But all of the display, all of the noise, all of the glamour, and all of the color and excitement, they exist only in the memory. But the spirit, the will to excel, the will to win, they endure, they last forever. These are the qualities, I think, that are larger and more important than any of the events that occasion them." In the 60s, Lombardi feared more people were turning away from competition and fewer were striving for perfection. Why? His answer was the theme of the fourth block. Too much freedom, not enough authority. Though his speech addressed the changing world of that decade, his words here echoed the lessons he'd learned 30 years earlier in the ethics class of Father Ignatius Cox. "For most of the 20th century," Lombardi said, "we as individuals have struggled to liberate ourselves from ancient traditions, congealed creeds, and despotic states. Therefore, freedom was necessarily idealized against order, the new against the old, and genius against discipline. Everything was done to strengthen the rights of the individual and weaken the state and weaken the church and weaken all authority. I think we all shared in this rebellion, but maybe the battle was too completely won. Maybe we have too much freedom. Maybe we have so long ridiculed authority in the family, discipline in education, and decency in conduct and law, that our freedom has brought us close to chaos." When Father Cox was teaching young Vinnie Lombardi from his textbook, Liberty, Its Use and Abuse, back in the mid-30s, he feared that liberty already had taken a dangerous turn. "The evidence for this lies all around us," Cox wrote. "Such liberty, unrestrained by law, which ultimately proceeds from the supreme lawgiver, God, has eventuated in license. Disintegralization has become the characteristic of modern life in morals, in science, in education, in government, and in international relations. The vaunted liberty which was to make us free has eventuated in a more galling servitude to man's lower nature, especially to sex on the one hand and to autocratic political power on the other. It is only the truth which can make us free. And the truth is that liberty, unchecked by law, the natural law of God and human law in accordance with the law of God, leads to license and thence to servitude. In his lament against license, Father Cox drew on the 1888 encyclical of Pope Leo XIII, attacking the doctrines of liberalism. Lombardi could not turn to his church now for the same traditionalist material. U.S. Catholicism was in the throes of liberalization itself in the aftermath of Vatican Council II. English was replacing Latin in most services. Parochial schools were turning away from the rote memorizing of dogma. Abstinence was no longer required on Fridays. And a majority of American Catholics were telling pollsters that they disagreed with church policy on birth control and divorce. Lombardi had mixed feelings about the reforms, according to his friend Jack Kepler, who attended several religious retreats with him at St. Norbert during that period. He welcomed the ecumenical spirit and the church's renewed emphasis on solving secular issues such as poverty and racial discrimination. But on the rituals of the Mass, Kepler said, Lombardi was essentially a pre-Vatican II type of Catholic. He knew Latin and liked the old traditions. During an era when some young Catholic clerics were shedding their collars to work in experimental urban ministries, Lombardi was turning the other way, retreating in his mind to the days when he had trained at the pre-seminary Cathedral Prep, and a father had led the boys in a chant, "I want to be a priest." Father Lombardi? His secretary, Ruth McCloskey, walked up the stairs at work one morning and noticed that the door between their offices was shut. It was never closed. This made her curious. And all of a sudden, the door opened, and there he stood in the doorway with all these priest robes on, and he had a mitre with a tassel, everything. He stood there, and I said, "My God!" He said, "How do I look?" I said, "I'm afraid to say. You look like a bishop or something." Then he heard somebody else coming up the steps and closed the door and reopened it 5 minutes later wearing his regular suit. Mr. Lombardi never mentioned it to me again, and I never brought it up. Lombardi could adjust to some of the reforms within the modern church in 1967, but he was surprised and alarmed by the larger counterculture movement emerging in America. As he acknowledged later, he'd been so wrapped up in his own world, in his God and family, and especially the Green Bay Packers, that he had not seen it coming, and then all of a sudden there it was, all around him. As he was embarking on his journey to deliver the speech in New York, students at the University of Wisconsin were burning draft cards to protest the war in Vietnam. The U.S. troop buildup in Southeast Asia had recently doubled to 400,000. The number of young American men who had fled to Canada to avoid military induction had exceeded 5,000. At a national gathering of student body presidents in Ann Arbor, a letter was being drafted attacking President Lyndon Johnson for his handling of the war. Plans were being set for a massive anti-war march on Washington in April. Noam Chomsky, an influential radical intellectual, was announcing in the New York Review of Books that he was withholding half his income taxes to protest the war, arguing that the time had come to resist authority. The February 6th edition of Newsweek featured a story on the other side of the movement, the disengaged hippies. The article described a human be-in staged at Golden Gate Park on January 14th, the day before the Super Bowl, at which 10,000 long-tressed hippies of both sexes and various fellow trippers gathered around a psychedelic maypole, burned incense, played recorders, chanted Hare Krishnas with Allen Ginsberg, and were encouraged by Timothy Leary to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Hendrik Hertzberg, a Newsweek writer, visited a pad in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, near where Harold Lombardi had lived a few years earlier. The hippies there told him that repetitive work was blasphemy, and that God intended for people to play. They lived cooperatively in reaction to the competitiveness around them. You're brought up in a competitive society, and you're taught to grab first because if you don't, everyone else will, one said. All of this was deplored by Lombardi as a dangerous disregard for authority and an abuse of liberty. In his speech, he put it this way. I am sure you are disturbed like I am by what seems to be a complete breakdown of law and order and the moral code which is almost beyond belief. Unhappily, our youth, the most gifted segment of our population, the heirs to scientific advances and freedom's breath, the beneficiaries of their elders' sacrifices and achievements, seem in too large numbers to have disregard for the law's authority, for its meaning, for its indispensability to their enjoyment of the fullness of life, and have conjoined with certain of their elders, who should know better, to seek a development of a new right, the right to violate the law with impunity. The prevailing sentiment seems to be if you don't like the rule, break it. This led to Lombardi's next theme, block 5 of his speech. Discipline. It was not just an abuse of liberty, but a lack of disciplined leadership that had brought disarray to modern society, he maintained. It could be that our leaders no longer understand the relationship between themselves and the people they lead. To properly understand that relationship, Lombardi believed, a leader had to appreciate a paradox. That is, while most shout to be independent, they at the same time wish to be dependent. And while most shout to assert themselves, they at the same time wish to be told what to do. In that sense, Lombardi thought the youth rebellion was not a reaction to stifling authority so much as a response to ineffectual leaders. This line of thinking went back directly to Colonel Blake. In December 1950, during Lombardi's second season at West Point, Blake made a similar argument in a letter to Dwight D. Eisenhower. I have been closely associated with youngsters for the past 20 years, and am convinced that our youth is more bewildered than at any time in our history, Blake wrote. As for the training of these youngsters, I hope it's realized, as in football, any course of training which envisions softness will not win the respect of the youngster. After he once gets into a system of training, all a young boy needs is understanding, fair treatment, and a two-fisted approach to the objective. What makes a great leader? This was Lombardi's next theme, block 6 of his speech. Here again, one could hear the echoes of the Jesuits and West Point. Leaders are made, not born, he said. They are made by hard effort, which is the price all of us must pay to achieve any goal that is worthwhile. In those two sentences, he combined the free will of Ignatius of Loyola and the price-paying of Colonel Blake. From there, however, Lombardi became less reliant on his mentors. As he described a great leader, he was describing himself as coach of the Green Bay Packers. A leader must identify himself with the group, must back up the group, even at the risk of displeasing his superiors. He must believe that the group wants from him a sense of approval. If this feeling prevails, production, discipline, and morale will be high, and in return, he can demand the cooperation to promote the goals of the company. He must believe in teamwork through participation. As a result, the contact must be close and informal. He must be sensitive to the emotional needs and expectations of others. In return, the attitude toward him should be one of confidence and possibly affection. The leader, in spite of what was said above, can never close the gap between himself and the group. If he does, he is no longer what he must be. He must walk, as it were, a tightrope between the consent he must win and the control that he must exert. To walk this tightrope, a leader had to find the precise balance between mental toughness and love, Lombardi said. The toughness came from Blake's notion of Spartanism. The love was Lombardi's concept of team. The love I'm speaking of is loyalty, which is the greatest of loves. Teamwork, the love that one man has for another, and that he respects the dignity of another. The love that I am speaking of is charity. I am not speaking of detraction. You show me a man who belittles another, and I will show you a man who is not a leader, or one who is not charitable, who has no respect for the dignity of another, is not loyal, and I will show you a man who is not a leader. I am not advocating that love is the answer to everything. I am not speaking of a love which forces everyone to love everybody else, that you must love the white man because he's white, or the black man because he's black, or the poor because he's poor, or your enemy because he's your enemy, but rather of a love that one man has for another human being. Heart power is the strength of your company. Heart power is the strength of the Green Bay Packers. Heart power is the strength of America, and hate power is the weakness of the world. The contradictions of Lombardi all came out in that long ode to love. He'd belittled players time and again on the practice field. He'd shown little charity or heart power for some who could not help him win, especially journalists covering the Packers. He sometimes incited hate power in players for the very purpose of spurring them on to victory. But if there was an obvious contradiction here, it was not necessarily duplicitous. Lombardi believed what he was saying, and most of the people closest to him, all of whom had suffered at various times, his players, his wife, his children, his assistants, his friends, believed him when he said it. He was such a forceful personality, said W.C. Hines, that if he hadn't been a good guy, he could have been a terrible danger. Lombardi's final theme, the seventh block of granite in his speech, concerned two inseparable qualities that he believed distinguish great leaders, character and will. All the men who took Father Cox's ethics class in the mid-30s had the intertwining definitions pounded into them day after day. Character is an integration of habits of conduct superimposed on temperament. It is the will exercised on disposition, thought, emotion, and action. Will is the character in action. Character in action, Lombardi asserted at the end of his speech, was the great hope of society. The character, rather than education, is man's greatest need and man's greatest safeguard, because character is higher than intellect. While it is true the difference between men is in energy, in the strong will, in the settled purpose, and in the invincible determination, the new leadership is in sacrifice. It is in self-denial. It is in love and loyalty. It is in fearlessness. It is in humility. And it is in the perfectly disciplined will. This, gentlemen, is the distinction between great and little men. Love and loyalty. What did they really mean? Where did they end and practicality begin? In the real world, apart from the rhetoric, those were difficult issues for Lombardi, and he had to face them immediately in his football life. 2 days after the New York speech, a special draft was held for the newest NFL expansion team, the New Orleans Saints. Each team had to make 11 players available to the Saints, who would pick 3 from that group. Lombardi included Paul Hornung on the list. He figured that Hornung was injured and at the end of his career, and assumed that New Orleans wouldn't take him. He wanted his golden boy to stay in Green Bay for personal and inspirational purposes, if not to start at left halfback. Jerry Kramer, the inquisitive right guard, who had just begun keeping a diary of the 1967 season, came by the Packers' offices on that afternoon of February 10th to pick up his mail. He met Lombardi walking out of the building and used the scene as the opening anecdote of Instant Replay, the extraordinary best-selling book he later wrote with sports writer Dick Schaap. I just stood there, and Lombardi started to speak again, and again he opened his mouth, and still he didn't say anything. I could see he was upset, really shaken. "What is it, coach?" I said. "What's the matter?" Finally, he managed to say, "I had to put Paul," he was almost stuttering, "I had to put Paul on that list," he said. "And they took him." The loss of Hornung hurt Lombardi more than anything I ever saw, said Max McGee. "He didn't put him on the list to lose him. It didn't make any sense for the Saints to take him." How did this mesh with his philosophy of love and loyalty? Had he been disloyal to Paul? For days afterwards, whenever Lombardi tried to talk about it, his reaction was the same as when he encountered Jerry Kramer. He choked and stuttered and sometimes cried. It was as though a son had been ripped from his arms. But there was more to it than Lombardi realized, more than love, loyalty, and family. The son wanted to leave for a better deal. I kind of orchestrated that, unbeknown to Lombardi. Hornung revealed later. He had placed a secret call to Tom Fears, the Saints coach, who had been an assistant in Green Bay. I called him. I knew my neck was bad. I said to him, "Vince is going to put me on the list." He said, "Oh, he wouldn't do that. How's the shoulder?" I said, "To tell you the truth, I don't know. I need to get it checked." He said, "Tell you one thing. If he puts you on that list, I'm going to take you. You'll make lots of money down here. You'll sell a lot of tickets." When the draft was held and the Saints selected him, Hornung expressed surprise. He told the press that he held no animosity against the Packers for putting him on the list, never letting on that he had wanted to go and had eased his own way, realizing that he could get far more money in New Orleans and his own television show in a big market. No way I'd tell Lombardi what I'd done. I was thinking money then, he explained later. The Saints took me. Lombardi was pissed and hurt. But that was business. It was big business in New Orleans. The Saints had the golden boy, and soon enough they had his old backfield mate, Jim Taylor, a Louisiana native who took the money and fled Green Bay after his contract option expired that spring. Lombardi's relationship with Taylor had been complicated. Their negotiations every year were nothing more than tests of stubborn will. Once, they sat in the room saying nothing, refusing to budge from their positions, until Taylor finally just got up and left. Paul was soft and easy. Jimmy was rock hard and difficult. Lombardi had insisted all year that Taylor was a great player and that the Packers couldn't afford to lose him. He believed it. And yet the day Taylor left, Lombardi had an appointment with his dentist, Bert Turek, and while sitting in the chair confided that as much as he admired his fullback's toughness, his leaving had brought a sense of relief. Taylor went to New Orleans in pursuit of liberty and money, as much money as he had seen the young Packers Anderson and Grabowski receive. He played there one frustrating season, the worst since his rookie year at Green Bay under Scooter McClain, and then his career was over. Hornung did not play at all. In July, he underwent tests at